Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. Many of us are concerned about climate change, about global warming, about whether it's real or not real, if there's misunderstandings, what the frame of reference is, what the truth is, and what the story is about it. And I have to tell you that today we have a tiger by the tail. Christopher Walter Monckton, 3rd Viscount Monckton of Brenchley, a British politician, journalist, and formerly a member of the Conservative Party. He has also been a deputy leader of the UK Independence Party since June 2010. He has served in a Conservative central office and worked for the Margaret Thatcher's number 10 policy unit during the 1980s. He's also worked for The Universe, The Sunday Telegraph, Today, and the Evening Standard newspapers. He became known in the 1990s for his invention of the Eternity Puzzle, a mathematical puzzle for which he offered a prize of £1 million to the person who could solve it within 4 years. He has come to the public attention in the UK and elsewhere for his outspoken skepticism about anthropogenic global warming. He is also an advisor to the Science and Public Policy Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Lord Christopher Monckton. Good evening to Copenhagen.
And good evening to you.
You have so much energy. I want to know where you get all that energy from. I want to take whatever you're taking.
Well, it's a daily bottle of champagne.
Is that right?
I wish.
How are you doing?
In fine fettle.
Well, fine settle. I'm going to have to come to Britain and learn all the proper language. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Pleasure.
It wasn't until I actually was willing to look into climate and weather did I realize the level at which I have been hypnotized as a human being and about global warming. I didn't realize how hypnotized I was until I did interviews before today. So I want you to know I am newly awakened in terms of the evolution of the industry, the IPCC, climate and weather science, and I'm very dedicated to distilling a frame of reference to the public that is so clear that people can separate the wheat from the chaff, because I really think that there is a global collusion to obstruct people's basic ability from seeing clearly.
Well, I think that's quite right. What's happened is that the governing class is worldwide effectively conspiring against the governed. It's decided that this global warming scare, which has been spun up and hyped up beyond all reason in just about all of the world's governments and all of the world's scientific institutions, is purely designed to extend the powers and the taxation and the wealth and the reach of government. And that's what's being attempted here in Copenhagen. What they're trying to do is set up a world government.
That's actually why I've invited you on. There's several questions I want to ask you. I've listened to a lot of your interviews that are online and on YouTube. I've gone to the Science and Public Policy site. I've read you're the chief policy advisor there. I would like to ask you questions that the public won't ask you to sort out some of people's lack of receptivity, first to hearing from you, and second to hearing the frame of reference that you're articulating. So the first thing I'd like to do to open the field so you can be better received. Now, first of all, I realize that you're very controversial. I've been controversial my whole life, so I relate. But you're controversial in a public figure kind of way. So recognizing that not only, you know, you're controversial, part of it is the minefield you're stepping into. But the other part of it is you appear to have blown out of nowhere and the public doesn't know who you are, where you came from. And even though you were a special advisor to Margaret Thatcher as the UK Prime Minister from 1982 to 1986, to the public who has no context for you, it looks like you blew out of nowhere in this climate thing. So maybe there's something you can say to the public to be able to receive you as like not just like somebody that blew in out of nowhere. That maybe you can say something to that.
Well, of course I can. What happened was I fell ill and for 25 years I was more or less out of action. And then I cured myself last year with a very interesting new use for a pre-existing medication. And we can now cure, so it seems, a very wide range of infections quite painlessly and very cheaply and very quickly. And so I suddenly, having made myself better, decided that I needed to get back into action again. And as it happened, just about that time, there was a merchant bank in the City of London, a small boutique finance house, whose chief executive had begun to smell a rat, rather as you've just begun to do, on the climate, and had thought that the propaganda shrieks from the people spinning this up were just a little bit too shrill to be. So he said, look, our analysts don't know what to make of this. I've consulted people on both sides, and there seems to be a lot of disagreement. Can you try to sort it out? So I had a look, having previously advised Margaret Thatcher, you know, 25 years previously, that this might turn out to be a problem, and I thought it might still turn out to be a problem. But I had a look, and I found, much to my amazement, that although the science was entirely clear that there was no longer a problem, we'd done enough science to know that adding CO2 to the atmosphere is pretty much harmless, an enormous industry had been created around pretending that it is harmful. And this industry was essentially committing what looked to me very much like scientific fraud, and indeed gaining a financial advantage by that fraud. And so I put in a 40-page report to the finance house saying, well, as best I can see it, this is no longer a problem, but there is this strange propensity on the part of the scientific community, with the active support of governments, the media, school teachers, and academia, to get together and pretend that there is a problem because they're all getting rich out of it. So I sent this to him, and he said, of course, I'm not a scientist, he said. I read what you say, and I have also spoken to the other side in the case, but all they gave me was lectures about how I had to believe it because there was a consensus. What you have told me is that there isn't a consensus. You've produced evidence from the scientific literature of widespread disagreement on all the main aspects of climate science, and you have done it in such a way that you haven't preached at all. You've just said this paper says this, that paper says that. You've given the facts. So I gave this guy the facts, and he was fascinated. So he sent it to the editor of the Sunday Telegraph, who at once got in touch and said, could I translate it into English, which I did. And I did a 2,500-word article in the Sunday Telegraph, which was then posted up on the Telegraph's website on the day of publication. Within 2 hours, it had received 127,000 hits on the website, and the website couldn't take the load, and it crashed. And that's the first and only time that the Sunday Telegraph's website, this is the website of a major national newspaper, has ever crashed. They've never had a response to any article before or since that was as big as they got.
Are you crashing? Are you, speaking of crashing, are you crashing the climate party in Copenhagen?
Oh, I'm here now. I'm in Copenhagen.
Some people may think you're crashing a celebration.
Well, I'm making a terrific nuisance of myself. I mean, I've been in the main conference hall, going up and down, talking to delegates, talking to campaigners, talking to kids who've been relentlessly propagandized by their wretched teachers. It's just like the Hitler Youth. I mean, last time Copenhagen had this amount of propaganda posted up and pasted up in every public square and on every public building was when the Nazis occupied this country.
Aren't you scared? Aren't you concerned? Aren't you concerned for your life?
No, because I really don't sort of go that far with conspiracy theories.
No, but I mean, you're really...
The danger to the entire project, if they were now to kill me, would be enormous, because even if I die of a cold, let's say, there'll be enormous suspicion that somebody's poisoned me in order to keep this fraud going. There's now so much concern among the public that they're not being told the truth by the media. They haven't to get it on the internet. They want to know about the ClimateGate emails, which reveal how nasty this clique of scientists that's been driving the global warming scare is. They have to go to the internet because the major newspapers don't tell them. If in that context, I were even to fall under a bus, people would be suspicious.
But, you know,
I think if anything, the other side would probably rather keep me alive and making a noise rather than make me a martyr by allowing me to die of anything.
I hear you. Well, let me just say this to you. One of the scariest things to me is that I started to do several shows on it because I really wanted to learn. I just was open. I just said, you know what? I really don't know about this. And I've been believing it for years. And I've also believed that CO2 would kill people because I bought it. And I didn't realize I bought it. And I posted it up on the sites. And sure enough, one of my guests, and I won't name the name, who I was going to invite as a guest on the show in a completely different field, said an associate went on the site and said, all you interview are climate deniers. And I said to the guy, let me explain something to you. First of all, I'm not in politics. I could care less. I do my show the way I want to do my show. I do my own due diligence. And nobody's going to tell me how to do due diligence about something that is coming up into international law that's going to change the face of the earth. And on a science that's not, does not have the consensus. I will interview who I want, when I want. I will ask whatever questions I want. And I'm not going to, bow down to being told who I should and shouldn't interview. But
well, now that, you see, is exactly what this banker said to me. He said the other side told him he wasn't even allowed to ask the question or he would be marked down and penalized in business because he was a climate skeptic.
Yeah, he called me a climate denier. And I said, and furthermore, sir.
Oh, yes, they do. They call you names. They call you denier.
It was unbelievable.
The Holocaust. I mean, it's outrageous. But the thing is that what he said was that my tone in speaking to him had been reasoned. You know, I wasn't here campaigning about anything. I was just saying to him, here's what the science says as best I can make it out. It's clear there's a division of opinion, but insofar as I can look at it and try and make out who's right, I think that it's probably the people who are not true believers in the new superstition, because they are the ones who, when I ask them questions, give me detailed answers, detailed calculations, references in the literature, take me seriously, whereas the other side are simply preachy. And I think you found the same.
I'll tell you what is absolutely frightening to me. There's two key components or three key components that are frightening. If, in fact, carbon dioxide is the seed, the ground of which this new industrial complex and its articulate laws, okay, binding laws and treaties is an outgrowth of, and the facts about carbon are falsified, that means that the public is going to ingest a falsity since we're made of carbon. And carbon is the breath of life. So Sherwood Itzo, who's dedicated 40 years of his life to this, this is so wild. How is it that a new industrial complex can be ushered in and hijack all of the people who do care about the environment? And by the way, I'm one of them. I've really been concerned about the environment, but I'll tell you what, I am not willing to agree that carbon is a pollution. I'm not willing to have the science falsified. I'm not willing to go with the flow and just like a sheep to the slaughter and say this treaty, which I haven't read, but which I've seen parts of it, is frightening. It really is the beginning, the face of the new government, is it not?
Well, the scale on which the bureaucratic coup d'etat that is planned is going to take place, if they get away with it, is enormous, and it can't be overstated. I've drafted international treaties, I've negotiated them, I've interpreted them at a pretty high level in government, and I have never seen anything on this scale transferred to an international entity before. The right to impose taxes on the West to the equivalent of half of the US defense budget every year, in addition to impose transaction taxes on all cross-border financial transactions of 2% of the value of that transaction, the ability to levy unlimited taxes and fines on airlines who have been singled out for particular hatred by the new entity, the creation of 700 new interlocking bureaucracies, each of which will be funded by taxpayers only in the West, the selective hammering of the West financially and in every other way by this new entity, so that all the jobs that now happen in our manufacturing and service industries will stream overseas to places like China and India, who will not be bound by this treaty and have said they won't be bound by it. the scale of the ambition of the UN's bureaucrats combined with world leaders around the world, even in the West, to do down the taxpayers of the West and the ordinary guy who thought that he was in control of his government because he could vote in and out whoever he wanted. The scale on which they're going to set up what is effectively a communistic world government. I say communistic for two reasons. One, in the 186 pages of the original draft, in the 40 or 50 pages of the draft that they've timed it down to now, the words election, democracy, ballot, and vote do not occur even once in connection with the democratic choice of the people who will compose these 700 new bureaucracies and the enormous powers they're going to have. So the principle of no taxation without representation is going to be breached, and breached on a most monstrous scale. People will have money taken from them at a rate of knots that they could never have believed possible before, and they will have nothing to show for it except unemployment, misery, and the collapse of the industries and the economic strength of the West. This treaty is a dagger aimed at the heart of Western democracy, freedom, and prosperity. And I just pray that whatever little we can do in the days remaining of us while we are still free, we can prevent this nonsense from happening, because it's happening just at the moment when the pretext for it, which is that carbon dioxide is somehow an endangerment, as the EPA has tried to say today, has been firmly and decisively disproven in the recent scientific literature.
The other big concern I have with this is that there is the enabling of an international monitoring apparatus with its attendant technologies to monitor CO2. It is Big Brother at the most virulent level, is it not?
Oh, yes, and it's already begun in Britain, which has long been a dictatorship run by commissars in Europe whom we don't elect and can't remove. We've already got a kind of world government on the regional level.
Didn't France?
Our parliament has abdicated and given its powers to unelected commissars whom we can't remove, can't replace, can't hold to account, can't even question. These commissars have dictated, for instance, that there shall be a microchip in every rubbish bin to make sure that each individual citizen throws the right pieces of paper into the right bin. And if they don't, then the thought police descend and take them away. And this is the sort of problem we are already into here in the UK, and it's going to get worse.
We have
a ludicrous figure who's the head of our environment agency in the UK, who has said that everyone will in future have to have a carbon credit card, and you're only allowed to emit so many tons of carbon footprint every year. And once you're up to your allocation, you've either got to buy an allocation from somebody else or starve. This is how ludicrous it is. It's going to be socialist rationing on the most meticulous and miserable scale of intrusiveness. As you rightly say, there's snooping, there'll be cameras everywhere, inspectors with clipboards wandering around your home, filtering through your rubbish bins, your garbage bins. There's going to be no end of bureaucrats making a fortune at your expense and making your life miserable if any of this goes any further. And the horrifying thing about it is that there's absolutely no need for it. And even if there were any sort of threat from carbon dioxide, even if the UN hadn't, as it has, exaggerated the effect of CO2 in causing warming in the atmosphere between 3 and 6-fold, depending on which scientific paper you read, even if that were not the case, we would have to close down all of our industries for 23 years. That means a complete shutdown of the economy, going back to the Stone Age without even the right to light a carbon-emitting fire in our caves in order to forestall just 1 Fahrenheit degree of temperature increase. And that's if the UN's right about the warming effect of CO2. If it isn't right, make that more like 200 years for 1 Fahrenheit of CO2. Now, clearly, 200 years of total economic shutdown just to prevent 1 Fahrenheit of warming is absurdly disproportionate. The number of deaths that would go, they would wipe out about 5 billion of the 7 billion on the planet.
Well, maybe that's the intent.
Well, it may be that this is their aim. I don't know, because unfortunately so much of this has been done in the dark, behind closed doors, by people that we cannot trust because they will not trust us to tell us what they're about. But I can't tell you what their motives are All I can say is that having read the ClimateGate emails, which reveal a vast conspiracy between all the leading scientific institutions and scientists working with the UN on its climate panel, these people are very nasty people. They are malevolent people. You read the emails, they are full of hate and spite and nastiness and cheating and fraud. And everyone who's been reading these emails, including those who previously supported this climate nonsense, is now saying, what on earth have we done agreeing with these people without having checked? And I at least can be proud to say that I smelt the same rat that this merchant bank smelt when it called me in. And the moment I began looking at what they were doing, it was clear that these people were up to something. Now we have the proof I've long been looking for, that all the people I've been watching are linked, and linked very closely by daily emails between each other, plotting how to keep this scare going and how to get rich on it at your expense and at mine.
The thing is that it's kind of like a paradox, in a sense that the people that are referring to these leaked emails, you have to understand, which I'm sure you know better than most, that that's a blip on the screen. Just a blip on the screen in the overall gestalt of what's occurring. To me, the devil's in the detail of the treaty. The treaty is the consciousness, the organistic framework by which the ground of everything is, its purpose is to roll out. The devil is in the treaty.
The treaty is the legal framework.
Well, that is, that's everything.
Once a nation has signed it, it will be bound by, to it forever, because, of course, they've been very careful not to include in this treaty the provision that is included in the original treaty setting up the Conference of the States Parties to the Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Is that available to the public?
That treaty, the original treaty, it all up in the first place, is available, and that treaty gives any nation the right to secede. That means to have nothing further to do with the Convention on Climate Change at will by notifying the other parties and giving them, I think it's 3 months notice or something like that. Now, that is quite a normal provision in international treaties, but the framers of this new treaty, this sinister world government treaty with vast amounts of taxation and regulation power, there they have put in no provision for any nation having signed this treaty to get out from under it again, unless the standard provisions for seceding from international treaties in the absence of any provision in the treaty apply, and that is you'd have to get the agreement of all the other states' parties to that treaty before you could secede. And since America, for instance, Canada likewise, are on the paying end of this treaty and not on the receiving end, I can tell you for free that the third world countries who are going to sign this treaty because it doesn't bind them and they hope it will make them rich, or at least it will enrich the bank accounts of their leaders in the Swiss and Belgian banks, those people are never going to let you out. They will keep you in. They will confine you. They will imprison you in this treaty once Obama signs it, once Stephen Harper signs it. If he does, I hope he won't. I'm quite sure that the commissars of the European Union will sign it because, of course, they already believe in communist central government with no democratic input, and they'd be very happy to see that spread to the rest of the world.
Hasn't the European Union taken over the city of London? Hasn't the European Union just taken possession of the city of London?
It has indeed, and I remember having breakfast one morning with the Lord Mayor of London. This was about 25 years ago, at the time when the question was where the European Central Bank was going to be put, and I was writing editorial comments for a very influential newspaper in London at the time called the Evening Standard, and he was wanting to lobby me to persuade me to write saying that the European Central Bank should be situated in London and not, as it is now, in Frankfurt. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that, because Britain is not going to join the euro, not by the will of its people. And I said, what is worse, it is quite clear that in the next few years, the European Union will start making moves to take over the regulation of the City of London. And within a year of that happening, the City of London will be a busted flush and people will be queuing to get out. And I can now give you some rather interesting figures. because where is everybody going as they leave the City of London like rats from a sinking ship? All the big brokerage houses, all the big finance houses, all the big insurers, they're all getting out while the going is good, and they're going to Switzerland, which is outside the dead hand of this European dictatorship. And the canton of Zug, which is where all the financial centres are, has had to close for the first time in history its list of corporations wishing to move there because there are simply so many of them. The flight from Britain has begun. The end of the City of London is at hand. That little square mile of land with its boys in red braces used to generate something like 1/8 of the entire gross domestic product of Britain. Now we are going to lose that and lose it forever because our politicians didn't have the foresight to see what it was that Europe was trying to do to us. And I say Europe, I don't mean the peoples of Europe, whom we love and admire and like to work and play with. I mean the Europe of this sinister bureaucracy which the European Union has become. That Europe which has a parliament purely as a fig leaf of democracy. That parliament of Europe has no power to propose legislation. It has no power to decide legislation, because if it does, the unelected commissars can override it. It has no power to amend legislation, because once again, the commissars can, and very nearly always do, override any amendments that it may make. It is a Duma or talking shop, not a real parliament, and it is purely there to convince people that the European Union is democratic, really, when in fact, as one Danish MEP put it to me many years ago, if the European Union were to apply for membership of the European Union, its application would be decisively and unhesitatingly rejected on the grounds that it does not comply with the requirements that member states should be democratically elected.
How did this happen? How did the European Union become so powerful? I don't get it.
By exactly the same method as the world government is hoping to become powerful. By stealth. It was done by getting the agreement of the political class in each of the member states, the first of all the civil service bureaucrats who aren't elected themselves and work in the shadows and hate the fact that every few years there's a change of government and a change of policy and they have to change here and point in a different direction. They hate that. They want to run the thing permanently themselves without interference from politicians. The European Union allows them a new forum in which they can do that. And what the European Union very craftily did, and it's exactly the same thing that's proposed in this treaty which is being negotiated in Copenhagen, is they managed effectively to recruit the national civil service bureaucrats in each country as the agents of the central dictatorship. Each little bureaucrat acts as a satrap, if you like, of the Persian Empire. He acts as the local goon who enforces the will, the Gauleiter under the Nazi system, who enforces the will of the Führer. And this is really what it is. It is essentially a fascist or communist structure in which there's no input of democracy at any point and therefore no input of common sense at any point, which the political class is prodigiously enriched, both in its powers and in its wealth at the expense of taxpayers, in which there is virtually no added value for taxpayers from the existence or antics of the European Union at any level. And precisely that structure has been copied, almost carbon copied, into the new international global government treaty. But they're not even going to bother to have the fig leaf of an elected parliament. They don't want to slow the process down by having a parliament that has even the right to speak out and say, hang on a moment, the emperor has no clothes. It's all nonsense. They aren't even going to allow that. It's going to be a dictatorship, and an avowed dictatorship right from the start.
And I noticed that there's a huge propensity of celebrities around the world that are being ushered in, pulled into the fold to be the voice pieces of the fact that global warming is an atrocity. In other words, it literally is unfolding as a kind of religious phenomenon. And if you don't go with the flow...
It's very sinister. What happens is somebody who is perhaps prominent but not generally agreeing as heartily as they would wish with the new superstition is called quietly in and is given a talking to. Oh, boy, do you want that zoning permit for the extension to your new house? You just go along with us on this global warming thing, make a couple of speeches in favour of what we all know is the truth. Of course, they know perfectly well it's a lie, but this is what they say, and we'll get you your zoning permit. Or can we make you a UN ambassador for global warming? We'll pay you $250,000 a year and give you a private jet. You can go all around the world. This is how they're buying them. One by one, they're buying these names, who are then given enormous privileges. They're given UN passports so that they can't be accused of crimes if they kind of injure a prostitute or the things they get up to, or they get complete immunity from any sort of prosecution, and they get privileged status, they get limousines wherever they go, and of course, to the little people who operate in showbiz, this all goes to their heads. They start feeling important, and they enjoy it, and so they are effectively bought. And this is happening all over the world now. And unfortunately, there's only a few very tiresome people like me who are saying, just a moment, I've read this document. I've never seen anything so appalling in all my life. Can we please stop this nonsense straight away? Now, fortunately, I am getting the media are beginning to become a little kinder, because I think some of them have realized that once you establish a world dictatorship, one of the things that dictatorships tend to do is to start messing around with the freedom of the media. Now, at the moment, of course, the media have become not so much mirrors of the establishment at the Times used to like to call itself. They're now its poodles, but they might not want to be its poodles forever. And I think some of them are beginning to realize that if they go on peddling this global warming nonsense and allowing the environmental correspondents to be the lions of the newsroom, when previously they were always in some odd corner and got a few column inches a year. If they go on doing that, then the likelihood is that this dictatorship will eventually decide to come along and start interfering with the freedom of the press, or even with the right of the press to exist. Let me tell you one thing they're going to do.
I know they want to do something with
that. They're going to say that one of the biggest sources of garbage in the world is newspapers, and they're going to forbid the newspapers to be printed because it's a waste of resources. That's the sort of thing that's going to happen. And eventually, when a few of the news media begin to wake up, and one or two of them are beginning, then suddenly the worm will turn and this whole program will be flung into retreat. Now, I don't know whether we can stop this at Copenhagen, but I can tell you this. If they don't get this legally binding treaty that they would like to get at Copenhagen, this is their last chance saloon. It's not the last chance for the planet. It's the last chance for the world government wannabes, because if they don't get this through, then it will become apparent as yet another year without any major rise in global temperature passes, that it's becoming impossible to sustain the notion that somehow within the rest of this century, there's going to be a 5 or 6 Celsius or a 10 Fahrenheit degree in temperature warming. It's just not going to happen. Nobody's going to believe it. They're trying to drive it through now because they know that every opinion poll shows that public support for this nonsense is collapsing with a greater rapidity than any other subject I've ever seen in opinion polls. That's been the same in Canada, the United States, Britain and Australia, and in New Zealand.
Do you know,
all of these, the people are fed up.
Do you know how I can tell when something is rotten that's going on the world stage? I'll tell you.
Tell me your method. I have my own.
Well, I'll tell you one of the ways I look and I can tell quickly is speed. The minute you have massive speed and coordination to push something through, you know that there has been a plan for a long time. When all of a sudden there's a synchronization to speed and push it through, and the people are called in all over the media to push it, and in a massive gravitational push so that it can't be stopped. It is like
exactly what is happening.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting. The plan, in fact, for this particular scam happened a very, very long time ago now. It happened, in fact, in 25 years ago when Sir Maurice Strong, a Canadian UN bureaucrat, deliberately set up the UN's climate panel as a political rather than a scientific body, precisely so that he could eventually turn it into a world government. He said at the time, incautiously, I think, that that's what he was going to do. Many others, from Gorbachev to Jacques Chirac to Al Gore, have made the same points about their desire to see this hideous mechanism turned into a world government. And so it has been very long in the planning. They had thought that they'd managed to capture all the major media, that they'd managed to get the people where they wanted them, and then literally about a year ago, the cracks in the dam began to show. The opinion polls began going rapidly the other way, long before even the ClimateGate emails that told us how nasty the plotters in the scientific world were. Even before we knew that, it was very, very clear that the public were going off this idea. And it wasn't just because of recession either. It was because one thing that Joe Public is very good at spotting is when he's being lied to systematically. You can get away with a lie for a short time, but in the end, the sheer shrillness of the propaganda begins to irritate the ordinary guy. And then if he listens to somebody like me, just quietly expounding the truth, as I'm trying to do now, he can tell the difference. And that's when the ordinary guy says, well, I can't work out whether Monckton knows the science better or whether the UN's climate panel knows the science better. But I can tell that the UN's climate panel and its supporters are becoming hysterical in their desire to make me believe something which is not a matter of belief. Science is not a belief system. And I'm not prepared to be bullied. And I think that's why the opinion polls are turning. It's because people aren't prepared to be bullied. And they're saying, we're not going to be told by these bureaucrats, by the great and the good, by our governors, by our teachers, by our academics, by our media, how we should think for ourselves on an issue like this. We're going to start thinking for ourselves. And of course, the moment anybody starts checking any of the science on, they immediately turn away. I'll give you a story on this. There was a guy called Andrew Tyrie, a very senior member of the Conservative opposition in London at the moment. Now, he began to look at the science because his party is told by its leader that you have to believe in global warming. But he decided to check for himself just to make sure. And he found, as anybody who's got half a brain who checks it, that the whole thing's nonsense. So he went to see David Cameron, the true believer who leads the Conservative Party, not really a Conservative, but he leads the Conservative Party anyway. And he said to him, look, David, I think we do have a problem here. He was very nice about it. He said, I've looked at the science, and I really don't think we can go on pretending that global warming's a problem. We're going to look silly when it eventually becomes apparent that it isn't. And David Cameron's reaction was to sack him on the spot, to fire him, throw him out of the shadow cabinet, cast him back onto the back benches, where he has very little influence, because the true believers are not willing to have anyone, however politely, questioning any aspect of the superstition in which they so fervently believe, rather than checking.
Isn't it like the Dark Ages?
The ordinary guy can see this. Yeah, sorry, you go next.
It's very much like the Dark Ages. I mean, I cannot believe the fervor, the zealotry, the religious spirit that has encompassed this subject. I'm stupefied.
That is the thing. It isn't, of course, a religion. It's a superstition, because the Christian religion, if you're old-fashioned like me, is true. And you believe it to be true. And you know that that's a matter of belief. You can't prove it to anyone else, but you believe it. And I believe it. But these people, they are believing not in a religion, but in a superstition. And a superstition is something which we can demonstrate by scientific methods to be false. Mm-hmm. You can't demonstrate the Christian religion by scientific methods to be false, because when Almighty God made the universe, the rules of the universe, which are the laws of physics, only came into being a fraction of a second after he said, let there be light, and there was light. And we now know that that was 13.7 billion years ago. You know, we can measure when it was. But the fact is, we can never, therefore, question whether or not there was a God by any scientific means. Therefore, it is legitimate intellectually to believe in God if we wish to do so. But to believe in this chimera of climate change is not respectable, because it is testable by science. It has been tested by measurement at everywhere, from the oceans to the clouds to the tropical upper troposphere and to outer space itself. And at every point, all the way up the atmospheric column, from the surface of the sea to outer space, there have been measurements taken which fundamentally disprove the key assumptions on which the computer models are, on which the entire edifice of climate change alarmism are based. Every single aspect of those models has been proven by measurement to be wrong. And therefore, you can only believe in climate change if you are a superstitious believer and not a religious believer. This is a superstition, not a religion.
That's an interesting point. Another thing that was very interesting in my original due diligence with this subject is to understand that looking at climate requires that we look at the context of time always when we make an assertion about climate or weather, that you're taking a snapshot of something, but you have to say to the public, what kind of timeline are we looking at? How long has this been going on? This is happening.
That's a really good question. Let me give you some answers on this, because I had the privilege just today to listen to Professor Ian Plimer, one of the world's foremost geologists, Professor Emeritus at the University of Melbourne, now Professor Regnant of Mining Geology at the University of Adelaide. And he gives a masterly presentation where he takes you back to the formation of the Earth 4,500 million years ago, and he describes the enormous changes of the climate that have taken place since then. Let's come back just to something a bit closer to our own time. Since about 600 million years ago, the temperature has been warmer than the present nearly throughout those 600 million years. It's been warmer than the present in each of the last four interglacial warm periods over the past 600,000 years. And in the present warm period that began 11,400 years ago, we can tell that from measurements of ice cores that are stratified and go all the way down by the years, and you can literally count what the temperature was by measuring the ratio of different isotopes of oxygen in the trapped in the air in the ice. So we can work out that 11,400 years ago, it began to become warm. And between 7,000 and 8,000 years ago, it was 3 or 4 Celsius degrees warmer than the present. It was warmer than the present again in the Minoan warm period that led to the great civilization at Knossos on Crete, which then was eventually brought to an end by the volcanic eruption at Santorini, which once again ushered in a cold period. Then we had another warm period in Roman times, which led to the flowering of the Roman civilization. Then we had another warm period in medieval times, which led to the flowering of the Middle Ages civilization. All the great cathedrals of Europe were built. They were growing grapes in Scotland all the way up to Hadrian's Wall. You certainly can't do that now. They were burying their dead at Valsøy in Greenland. The Vikings were in the Middle Ages. And that burial ground is under permafrost to this day. And what I'm doing here is doing exactly what you say, and you're quite right about this point. I'm putting it in the perspective of time. And when did the present warming begin? Actually, it began in 1695. We know why it began. It began because there'd been 70 years with virtually no sunspots, and then gradually the sun began to recover its activity, and as it did so, so the world began to warm up. And between 1695 and 1735, in a period of 40 years, according to the oldest instrumental temperature record in the world, which is the Central England temperature record, the temperatures in Central England, and by implication, probably something like this happened throughout the rest of the world, rose by 4 Fahrenheit degrees in 40 years, the equivalent of roughly 9 or 10 Fahrenheit degrees in a century. And yet, the entire warming of the 20th century, about which all this fuss is being made, was not 10 Fahrenheit degrees, it wasn't 4 Fahrenheit degrees, it was just over 1 Fahrenheit degree. That's what all this fuss is about. And so you're quite right. The moment we put this in any kind of historical context, we see what nonsense it is to assume that the main driver of the climate today is the tiny addition of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere of 2 parts per million per year, which is all that we're able to achieve.
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Now, is there a way for people to go to scienceandpublicpolicy.org and download a copy of the treaty?
Yes, indeed they can. They'll get a copy of the original version because I haven't yet managed to get a copy of the latest draft in electronic form. I have it in paper form. But we are working on that. I'm talking to the UN about it tomorrow. I had to battle like mad to get a paper copy of the new version of the treaty, because when I went to the document distribution center in the conference center here in Copenhagen, the librarian took one look at me and said, oh, no, there's no such thing as a negotiating text. What do you think this is? I said, this is a conference which is negotiating the text of a treaty. I therefore require to see the negotiating text. And she looked completely baffled and went to consult her colleagues, and they all came back scratching their heads. And they said, we don't know. We've never heard of such a thing as a negotiating text, a negotiating draft. No, no, no. This isn't about a treaty at all. And I said, look, I'm going to come back in a few moments. I've got to go away and do a television interview. When I come back, I expect to be given a copy of that treaty without further argument or prevarication or excuses or delay. And if I don't, then as a member of the House of Lords, in good standing, I am going to make a very loud diplomatic incident about how secretive the UN is being in keeping from the people the true contents of this treaty.
Would you share with the...
I went away and did the interview and I came back and they said, well, we have got a kind of very large pile of papers that we do hand out to people. And they gave me this stack about 2 inches thick, about 1,000 pages. And I began looking through some of it, was mainly rubbish. But right at the bottom of the stack, the last 20 or 30 pages, that was the draft treaty. And they had even tried to hide it from me when they eventually realized they were going to have to give it to me. And this is exactly the same as they had hidden it. The way they hid the first draft of the treaty, they put it on their website, but it was entitled Note by the Secretariat of the State Parties to the Convention on Climate Change. It didn't mention that this note was only 2 pages long, had a huge treaty, 186 pages long, attached to it. That's how they hid it. Why did they put it up on the website at all? Because you know the game as well as I do. What they were going to do is they were going to spring this horrifying world government on us, get all of the member states to sign up. If the treaty is long enough, you'll find the negotiators just don't bother to read it from the member states. They'll sign anything, basically, once they come to one of these jamborees and are given enough to eat and drink by the host government. And once they've signed it, then, of course, they look at what they've signed and say, oh, my God, how did we ever sign this? And then the UN just smarmily says, well, of course, you could have looked at the draft on our website at any time. But, of course, you'd never have found it if you'd looked for it.
Can you share with the audience who would never ask you directly, what is the House of Lords? What makes somebody a lord? Can you give people a context?
Yes, certainly. The House of Lords is one of the most ancient legislative bodies in Britain. It's actually older than the House of Commons. And it was originally composed of the barons, who were the nobles whom the king needed because they owned tracts of land and could raise armies to fight on behalf of the king. And eventually, at 1215 at Runnymede, was signed Magna Carta, by which the king gave a large amount of his authority to the nobles. And then gradually, over the succeeding centuries, the House of Commons, which was elected, gradually acquired more and more authority. And then in 1906, the House of Lords was stripped of its ability to vote at all on bills to do with taxpayers' money. And then in 1949, it was no longer allowed to oppose any bill that the Commons sent up to it for more than 6 months. It could impose a six-month cooling-off period, but it couldn't ultimately stop the Commons passing any legislation. And then in 1999, the House of Lords, many of whose members were at that time hereditary, as I would become at that time, my father was a member of the Lords, lost the right to sit or vote. And I no longer have the right to sit or vote in the House of Lords, though I am a member of it. I am a peer of the realm. So it's a rather strange, I'm a kind of constitutional throwback, if you like. I'm a piece of political archaeology in practical terms. But the great thing is that a title still conveys with it a certain authority which one can exploit when explaining to people things which the House of Commons and the elected government and the appointed lords, who are now appointed by the Prime Minister of the day, no longer convey. I have, if you like, on a good day, more authority, more access to the minds and hearts of the people than the appointed lords, who are merely the poodles of the establishment in the House of Commons.
Got it. Very interesting. I think that you're probably right about that. But I think that for the general population who doesn't understand the House of Lords, what a lord is, what makes someone a baron, how it works, how it was set up, I think that was a good synthesis. My question.
That's a nice bit of history, anyway.
Yeah,
and
very
it
good.
It is one of the most ancient legislative bodies in the world. And also, funnily enough, even when it was largely filled with hereditary peers, it turned out usually to be more democratic than the Commons, because the Commons, as one of our great constitutional theorists, Lord Hailsham, once put it, is an elective dictatorship. Once you've elected the Commons, they dictate for 5 years. You know, the government of the day has absolute authority as long as it has a majority in the House of Commons. But the Lords would often stand up and speak against the Commons for the rights of the common man when the Commons were getting too much above themselves. And this was because, as hereditary peers, We didn't have to be elected by anyone. We didn't, therefore, necessarily belong to any particular party or take any party whip. We could speak and think and vote according to our conscience in the way that no member of a party ever can. And that gave us a terrific vigor and independence, and also a range of ages. There were far more young people who had inherited their title from fathers who died early, for instance, than there were in the Commons. So we were a younger house, a more vigorous house, a more active house, in many ways, a far more representative house than the house of the elected representatives of the people. So it did have a curious value, which in the end, of course, was going to be swept away by the arrogant Commons. And sure enough, this eventually happened in 1999. And in due course, I think what we're going to do is to move towards something much more like the American Senate, which will be a fully elected house. And I think there are only two correct things to do with the House of Lords, either to restore the hereditary peerage to its full glory, which in these days is probably not going to happen. It's just unrealistic to think that anyone can any longer put up with that, valuable though in some ways it was, or to go completely the other way and have 100% elected upper chamber, and you would elect them on a different cycle from the House of Commons and for perhaps a longer period. They're not necessarily for life as they are at the moment. And in that way, you'd get a nice balance, which, of course, was so carefully and so sensibly thought out by the framers of the American Constitution in that long, hot summer in Philadelphia 200 years ago.
Which I was just going to bring up with you, because, in fact, most of the public here is not aware of the fact that the Constitution is not really in force anymore, A, and B, that with the stroke of a pen, an executive order can be written and bypass everything. The Constitution, the Bill of Rights, habeas corpus, Declaration of Independence, all of it. And so it's a very curious time to be alive right now in the United States. And
I think that if Obama were to try to use the executive order procedure or the executive agreement making procedure in foreign affairs, which he can use, if he were to try to use that, with a treaty of this magnitude, then whatever the Supreme Court might say to back him up, and of course he has his poodles in the Supreme Court now, they will vote by a majority for more or less whatever he wants them to vote for. Your Supreme Court is no longer a court of justice. It is a highly politicized and extremely unsatisfactory body. I think what will have is the one part of the Constitution, in my view, that has failed its original purpose because it's become too politicized. I think that if he tries to do anything like that, he will be impeached. I think I've talked to several constitutionalists in the United States, real experts on your Constitution, and they, unlike you, take a slightly more cheerful view, and they say that in most respects the Constitution is not only surviving, but working remarkably well, given the changed world it's now having to cope with. I think a lot of them, like me, share my concern that the Supreme Court has become too much politicized into one direction or another, depending on which party has managed to appoint its own political appointees to what should be roles that are above politics, but these days they no longer are. The latest appointment to the Supreme Court is a very clear example of that. It was an ideological appointment. It was a racialistic appointment. It was a very unsatisfactory appointment in an awful lot of different ways. And that's not to say that Madame Sotomayor is not a good lawyer. I just think that it was indicative of the way in which these appointments are now made. And it's a very unsatisfactory thing that a president can effectively stack the Supreme Court, provided that somebody who's reached a certain age steps aside and allows him to get the chance of making an appointment. And of course, there is a Senate ratification procedure, but by convention, the Senate basically in the end doesn't tend to stand in the way of the president's nominees. And so the Supreme Court isn't working. So there is some danger that what might happen is that Obama signs the treaty by executive order and then tries to bring it into force, perhaps by introducing it into both houses as domestic legislation. I think he won't now get away with that. He hasn't got the Waxman-Markey or Kerry-Boxer bills through. I don't think he now will. I think he's getting too close to the midterms for that. The entire House of Representatives, all of them, are up for election in the midterm elections this time round, as well as the usual one-third of the Senate. And I don't think that in an election year there will be any stomach, even among the Democrats, to try to push through any climate legislation, whether it be the bills on cap and trade they've been considering, or whether it be the even more radical and even more expensive and even more freedom-destroying and prosperity-destroying treaty which is being framed here in Copenhagen. I don't think they'll get that through either house. But there is a possibility that that wretched, politicized Supreme Court will be appealed to by one government body or another on the ground that Obama has signed this by executive order and that they want to start implementing it. And the Supreme Court will rubber stamp this and say they can, even though it hasn't been ratified. And unfortunately, there is no provision for impeachment of members of the Supreme Court, as far as I know. You can impeach the president, but you can't impeach the Supreme Court. They're untouchable. And they have, in my view, now too much power and too much of a disposition to use it, in effect, to create legislation in a way in which the framers of the Constitution had plainly never intended. But, of course, there is no body above the Supreme Court that can tell the Supreme Court that that was what the Constitution never intended. So there is a danger that a conspiracy, if you like, between the President and the Supreme Court could force this treaty upon the American people, even against the will of the Senate, which would otherwise have to ratify it by a two-thirds majority, a majority which it simply would never give to anything like the treaty that is in draft here in Copenhagen at the moment.
There is an entire psychology, and there is a psychology to saying no to this treaty, of saying no to this new law, because by saying no to this, people are accused of saying that they don't want to help the environment, that they don't want some type of checks and balances with regard to pollutions. In other words, the whole architecture of dialogue has already been framed so that if people look inside and they look deeply and they start seeing and asking the questions and doing the due diligence necessary, and by the way, I believe everybody should have a copy of that treaty. And I wish that it was possible to put yellow marks in critical places in that treaty so that the public doesn't have to digest 187 pages of it. But I really wish there was places that could be clarified and distilled so people could see and read the words. Because as you know, more than most, treaties are about international legal standing, and typically they never go away. Do you agree?
Well, the important thing is that a treaty tends to mean what it says. And although I was on Glenn Beck about a month ago with Ambassador John Bolton, who tried to say that this particular treaty didn't mean what it said, it does mean what it says. They are trying to set up a world government. And if that's what the treaty says, that's what they'll do. They have taken the word government out of the present draft, because they weren't getting away with that politically. But if you want a summary of what the main points are in the treaty, because they haven't changed much between the first draft and this one, then you can tell your listeners simply to go to just go onto YouTube and look up Monckton Video, and you'll see a four-minute clip of a speech by me in St. Paul, Minnesota, just a couple of months ago, mid-October last year, in which I summarize the whole thing and say what I think of it. And it's all just 4 minutes, and that's probably the easiest way to get a flavor of how very serious this treaty is, how very much it would go against your constitution. And there has been some remarkably stupid comment in some newspapers that ought to know better, saying that, of course, Monckton doesn't understand the U.S. Constitution, and, of course, this treaty won't prevail over the Constitution. But, of course, they haven't gone and done what I did, which was to go onto Capitol Hill, rootle out one of the most senior constitutional lawyers on the Hill that advises Congress full-time on the meaning of the Constitution and advises one of the constitutional committees of Congress. And as I walked into the room, which was heaped with piles of books all over every surface, I had to sit down practically on a pile of books. Before I'd even sat down, this expert, this lawyer said, constitutional lawyer said, this treaty trumps the U.S. Constitution. And he was absolutely unhesitant. He said, if this treaty goes through, it's no good pretending, as many are trying to pretend, that somehow the Constitution will prevail over it. It won't. The treaty will prevail, and your Constitution will be a dead duck.
I have a question about the UN. Can you explain the purpose of the UN to the public? I don't even understand the purpose of the UN. I don't get it. Who are they?
Now, I can give you some history here. After the First World War, there was a League of Nations created at the Treaty of Versailles. Unfortunately, the first thing it did was to get together and award savage reparations for Germany's war guilt, as it was called, in the First World War, because Germany had been defeated. And Germany was therefore obliged to pay crippling amounts of money to the Allied powers in restitution. And so crippling were these amounts of money that, in fact, the Treaty of Versailles led directly to the Second World War by putting Germany in an altogether financially impossible position from which she couldn't hope to recover except by fighting her way out. That's what happened. So the seeds of the Second World War were sown at the end of the First with the League of Nations. That League of Nations, of course, collapsed by the time of the Second World War. It had clearly failed, and failed abjectly. And so after the Second World War, it was decided there ought to be another go. So they set up the United Nations. Only this time, they set it up without giving it any powers to decide who got what after the Second World War. It was purely to be a talking shop for all nations. But it's now taken on a life of its own, and it has long since outlived any usefulness that once it had. And therefore now, what we're looking at is a body which primarily is concerned with getting more money for itself out of its member nations, and it has no other purpose but its own survival and enrichment and self-empowerment. And indeed, those are words which were used to me by one of its own very distinguished retired ambassadors, to whom I went to consult him on whether there was any longer any purpose in the UN. He said, no, there isn't. The best thing to do is to kill it off. You know, we've all got fax machines, mobile phones. We can telephone each other across nations. We no longer have to have a national or an international assembly where everybody can discuss these things, because they can discuss it directly by video conference link if they want. There's no need, he said, for the UN anymore. It is a waste of money, and politically it's becoming dangerous precisely because of its desire, entirely evident in the draft of this treaty, to empower itself and to turn itself into a world government, a desire which has is one of very long standing in the hearts of those who are, if you like, driving the UN. So the best thing now would be to lance the boil, blow up the UN building, and sack all the bureaucrats and give them no pension. The time has come to shut it down. And these are the words of somebody who actually lives next door to the UN building. He said, I'd love to blow it up. He said, we'd all have a better view if we did. Now, of course, I'm not advocating terrorism. Don't get me wrong. What I am saying is that, perhaps in rather colourful language, the time has come to bring this to an end.
Because I noticed that they had given Obama a very big, prominent position in the UN just a month ago.
Well, they gave him, they gave him the chance to speak to them, and then he was given the Nobel Peace Prize. All of that is designed to make him sign whatever is put in front of him at Copenhagen without looking.
Well, I really want to thank you for coming to It's Rainmaking Time and taking your time to discuss some of the most important legal aspects and social aspects of what's happening today. And I look forward to talking to you again, Lord Monckton of Brenchley.
Real pleasure, and thank you very much, and God bless America.
God bless you.